Hello everyone, this is Eva Nolik-Smith with Yoga You Online, and welcome to tonight's session, live Q&A session with Rodney Yee and Colleen Seidman Yee. I am very proud and pleased to introduce Colleen and Rodney. It's hard to know anything about yoga and not know Rodney and Colleen. We all know them from the series of excellent yoga DVDs they have both done, and they are among, of course, the most sought after and popular teachers at yoga workshops and yoga conferences. And as anyone who has practiced with Rodney and Colleen, for good reason, both Colleen and Rodney have become known for the depth of their teaching skills and the unique insights they bring to making the deeper aspects of yoga a living experience for their students. And in addition to their national teaching presence, Rodney and Colleen also are the creators of the yoga therapy aspect of the Urban Zen program. The Urban Zen Integrative Therapy program is a program founded by Donna Karen that aims to introduce programs into hospitals, and it incorporates non-traditional healing techniques into patient care. Rodney and Colleen, in addition, also are the authors of several books. And just this past June, Colleen's highly acclaimed book, Yoga for Life, came out, subtitled A Journey to Inner Peace and Freedom. Rodney and Colleen, welcome. We are so happy to have you.
So great to be on with you.
Thanks, Eva.
So the theme of our session tonight is on finding your inner yoga, just because that is such a fascinating topic. Most of us think about yoga, of course, in terms of yoga asana. And when we see yoga in the media or even in our own practice, we tend to focus on the yoga postures that are a main part of any yoga class in any yoga studio in the U.S. However, yoga is also, and perhaps even more so, about our inner experience. It's about finding our center and even about finding that part of ourselves that can stay centered, calm, and grounded even during times of challenge and upheaval. And ultimately, probably for most of us, that is the motivation that brings us to yoga. Yet it is very easy to get caught up in the externalized efforts to strike the perfect yoga pose and emphasize outer form over our inner experience. So first off, in your teaching, and in your own practice, which are some of the principles or themes you use to guide your students or yourself to facilitate the process of letting go and finding ease and space within rather than muscling our way into postures?
Well, I think that is what Rodney and I are all about, is finding the subtleties in the practice. But sometimes you have to go into the gross in order to just get the attention and to start to ease up the body, unwind the body, so that you can even feel alignment, breath, and eventually to meditation, which is hopefully where this is all leading us. But I think that asana is an important first step to be able to sit comfortably and watch the breath. And the breath is what's going to take you into that, quote, inner yoga. And then in that inner yoga, what can open up is incredible expanse, incredible possibility. Some call it love or divinity. But it takes a lot of work. It takes sitting with rather than running away from. And then sometimes it's too much. It's too powerful. You have to go back and just do. We actually taught 108 sun salutations tonight. It's sort of a ritual on Labor Day. And sometimes you just go back and do that. Yeah, it's completely fun. But what's interesting is we did a restorative pranayama and meditation practice right after that. And it was some of the deepest meditations that students have gotten in. So I don't think that you can say one is better than the other or one should replace
right.
another, but to integrate all of them.
A lot of times there are two sides to the same coin. And I like to liken it to architecture. It's great to have a well-designed building or a well-designed house where the light and the wind and the air travel through easily. At the same time, what's really important is to live inside the house or live inside the building. So both things, you know, we live in both a physical and a metaphysical world. So it's really important to engage both of those aspects of who we are. The great thing about the architecture, like Colleen said to start with, is that you're held accountable. You know, a lot of times people say, oh, they play music, but they play a lot of sound without necessarily any structure. And a lot of times people fool themselves without structure a lot of times. So the problem, though, with having structure then is a lot of people become really great technicians, but they don't actually live in the music. So it's really important to look at both aspects and not actually become totally infused in either or. But as in, like Donna Karan says, it's the end that matters. And so really you're looking at form and function and also formlessness and emptiness.
And also one of your parts of your question was then how do you take that into your life when things are difficult or traumatic, upsetting from the mundane to the bigger issues in life. And once you've tapped into that in a yoga class or in a meditation class, you have the tether to that. So even in the middle of great difficulty, you can stop, you can find the softness of your face, the smoothness of your breath. You can go, you can take your tether, your link back to that, what you're calling internal yoga. So it's always there. So I think that if you've never experienced it, if you've never had that kind of intimacy or spaciousness, then maybe it's more difficult to get to it.
You know what's really funny is when Colleen and I first got together, we would sit and do pranayama in front of each other, and it's still our daily ritual. But as we do that, and when we first started off, Colleen was much more apt to literally have out-of-body experiences, and I would watch her literally leave her body and go into deep states of meditation. On the other hand, I would have a very, like, strong posture, and she would laugh at me and say, you know, Rodney, why is your posture so stiff? But the irony is I would bring her back often, and she would actually bring me out. So there was this great synthesis between understanding that it's fabulous to have the form and the human form of the body and to be embodied, and yet at the same time live in the house of the spirit.
So the form with the formless.
Yeah, yeah. And Colleen, in your book, you have a practice sequence that specifically targets this process of finding greater ease and greater calm inside. And it's a yoga sequence that focuses on facing what scares us. And you have this beautiful quote by Pema Chodron. You say Pema Chodron teaches the importance of not running away from difficult emotions, that if we can sit quiet with them, eventually the expanse of the blue sky will appear. Tell us about this particular sequence and what inspired it.
As you know, because you read my book, I spent most of my life literally running, trying to escape the intensity of feeling. And I did that with extreme exercise. I did that with drugs. I even used prayer to do that. And I believe the chapter you're talking about was the chapter that I talk about my epilepsy and the fear that surrounds that, that can paralyze one.
Right.
And what Pema teaches us to do is just to stop and to be human, to feel the fear, to sit with the fear. We were watching a TED Talk the other night, and the woman, I can't remember her name, said that you sit down and you have a cup of tea with your fear. If you get up in the night and you're sort of panicked and frozen in fear, she's like, get up, make a cup of tea, and literally sit down with your fear, because it's the fear of the fear that's much greater than the object of the fear. My epilepsy has been an incredible teacher for me in that way, because there is no trigger. I never know when it's going to appear, and I can't live in fear. I refuse to live in that kind of fear that would lessen the possibilities of my life. And you wanted to know more about the sequence of that chapter?
Is that what you mean? I mainly what inspired that particular sequence, which you kind of addressed very beautifully. But it was just such a lovely theme and a lovely thought. But if you want to just comment a little bit about the sequence that you pulled out from that and how you selected that particular sequence of postures.
Well, if somebody is afraid, think of what their posture would be. They would be protecting their organs. They would be maybe curled up into a little ball. So my theory in preparing a sequence like this is to meet you where you are, which would be in child's pose or in fetus position or something like that. Mm-hmm. And eventually you want to get them into somewhat of a back bend. So that's more of a receptivity, an acceptance. So I believe what I did in this particular sequence is I started them in child's pose, and then I may have done a little bit of twisting, but then lying on the belly and do the back bends that are on the belly. So you start to open up the heart, but you still feel safe. You've got the floor underneath you. You're not exposed. And from there, eventually going into a restorative back bend. And I think that's a beautiful sequence for fear. And, if you have enough time, you can continue to build it until maybe you can get into a fish pose or a wheel pose. And then after that, what's really important, especially when dealing with fear, is to slow them down, to calm them down, to cool them down before you send them back into the world or yourself. To neutralize the spine, to do a Supta Padangusthasana, a reclined bound angle pose, final relaxation, with maybe even on your side for that, with your back against the wall. So if you're still afraid, you can open up your eyes and realize that it's okay right now. So that was the thinking for most of my sequences. I would take a theme like that, like fear or trauma or addiction, and just feel what does it feel like in the body? What does fear feel like in the body? And what would be the balance to that in a way that doesn't snap them so that they will recoil? So it has to be this beautiful, slow, mindful progression of opening and of balance.
I think what's important to remember, too, is some of these sequences can be done over a couple of months or even over a year. So when we're talking about uncoiling from fear, I mean, really deep-seated fear is really triggered very easily and deep set in the body. So Colleen's given these sequences, and they're amazing when you do them, for an hour a day or half an hour a day. But at the same time, you realize that it's a daily practice, sometimes over months, sometimes over a couple of years, to really get some of the deep-rooted difficulty out of the body.
Absolutely. One step is great.
Right.
People expect, overnight I'm just going to suddenly be better or be healed or everything is going to transform. But if you can go just little by little, I mean, Iyengar has this this thing that somebody asked him, am I ever going to be able to sit in Virasana? And his response was, get three of those New York City telephone books when they used to have them, and then every day tear one page out And then, you know, eventually in, you know, 20 years, you'll be sitting on the ground. And it's like that.
Yeah,
I think expectations have to be lowered a little bit.
You know, the thing that we're really trying to compel people to understand is the daily practice. And, you know, a lot of times people do go to class once a week, once a month, and that's all really wonderful. And, you know, we end up trying to be weekend warriors. But really the consistency daily in any of these traumas and any of these difficulties, even the simple things, when you address it a little bit every day, there's something that comes to you like a great friend. And this is an important aspect, and people should remember that if they can set aside a little time every day to do one or two or the entire sequence, one or two poses their entire sequence, they're really going to feel a great comfort inside the poses.
That's a beautiful point. Along the same lines of working on sort of longer-term goals, here's a question from Taylor in Oklahoma City. She says, I often feel that I rely too much on those around me to make me feel good about myself. Is there any practice that you can suggest or even any readings that will allow me to get in touch with my inner strength?
Well, I always love Krishnamurti's book, Think on These Things. It's very inward, and I think that as she's relying on other people and other external situations to make her feel good, I think she has to be brave, and I think she has to begin to spend a little time alone. Colleen's going to laugh at this because this is actually one of my difficulties. I find great pleasure in being in community. And so only till recently in my life have I started to spend much more time by myself, even with all of the yoga practice. And it's so beautiful. And you can't force these transitions, but you can encourage them. Again, find something that you do alone that begins to take you in that direction. And think about small steps. And relish, begin to relish a little walk on your own, or a little sitting meditation on your own, or reading a book on your own. Just these inward movements by yourself. And something is already, if you're already an adult, you've already cultivated great wisdom and great fortitude inside yourself. And now you have to trust that. And that trust comes little by little, just like everything else. And so a little activity daily, again, moving inwards and finding that trust is important.
It's funny. The introduction to my book is Know You're Enough. This is something that I have struggled with my entire life, is being seen, recognized for only the external. And as a result of that, my voice was muted for most of my life. And the truth is, until you know who you are, there's no way that you can be real, that you can be raw, that you can be honest, because you don't even know yet. So as Rodney is saying, you have to do the work to find out, who am I? And to realize that you don't have to lie. You don't have to hide behind some pretense or something that you think others want you to be, because you are enough. And people need to hear your fingerprint, what you have to say, your voice. And I think that we spend so long trying to become something, and I'm going to be happy when, and oh, she's got that, I don't have that, or he's, you know, and it gets to be exhausting and ridiculous. And it does take time. And it also takes making a lot of mistakes until you're like, okay, this is who I am. It's funny, I think that for a lot of women it happens at menopause. It's like you're sick of playing the game, and you burn up all of this trivials that you can step out and be, okay, this is who I am. And then what's interesting is when you're able to be that honest and that vulnerable, other people recognize that, and they then have the courage to shed their own stuff. I wanted to say shit, but I probably shouldn't say that.
So, you know, going back to these simple practices of sitting meditation, because we are talking about yoga, and going back to having maybe one or two asana practices a week that you're not doing in class, but you're doing at home. And also maybe not following a yoga video that, you know, but actually not knowing what to do and be alone in the room for 5 to 10 minutes and start to be creative. And I know a lot of people are scared of that. You know, they're scared of doing it wrong. We like to quote often this Zen book that basically says one continuous mistake. And it's a lot of times people think they're not getting it right. They're not enough, like Colleen's saying. These are the hindrances that keep people actually from delving deeper into the practices of sitting meditation, breathing work, pranayama, and just a home asana practice. We know that it makes a lot of difference when people actually start a home practice.
It's funny, Rodney talks about, you know, the home and clearing the home and living in the home, but also being comfortable in your skin is a really important thing. And yoga takes you there. When you spend that kind of time and that kind of intimacy, you begin to live in your home.
You know, the funny thing is Pablo Neruda writes this poem called Keeping Quiet. And it's about keeping quiet for 12 seconds. And, you know, most of us think 12 seconds is a short amount of time. But just, he says, could the whole world keep quiet for 12 seconds? And all of a sudden, we'd be left with a sudden uneasiness. And most of us, we back away from actually feeling that uneasiness that comes with seated meditation or a home practice. And that's the part that you actually, that's the hurdle that you have to begin to delve into. And at first, it's a formidable hurdle. And yet, if you pierce it, there is great joy.
Yeah, that's a beautiful point.
I have that poem here. If at the end you want me to read it.
Yeah, do you want to read it now?
Sure. It's called Keeping Quiet by Pablo Neruda. It says, now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. I want no truck with death. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us as when everything seems dead and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count up to 12 and you keep quiet. And I will go.
That's very profound. What a beautiful poem. And here we are, not 12 seconds, but we're already not so quiet.
Right.
You know, the irony is there are some meditation practices and teachings that say if you can meditate for 14 seconds uninterruptedly, that this state of enlightenment would be yours. And it's so interesting that Pablo Neruda picks 12 seconds, and at the end he says, well, I'll keep quiet, you know, and I will leave. And it's such an interesting statement because he says, I will leave. And in some ways, that whole sense of you and I might be gone. And so this whole feeling of separation that breeds desperation, alienation, and conflict may actually disappear from that quietness.
Very profound point. Now, following along on that theme of the barriers to practice, I think for most people, certainly, you know, meditation can be a challenge, but even for many people, just taking up a regular yoga practice and also taking up a regular home yoga practice can be challenging. And Phil in Mountainside, New Jersey, has a question. He says, my wife, Linda, has been teaching yoga for several years now, and I often assist in class. What kind of advice do you give people who try yoga and slightly get attracted to it but are disillusioned and want to quit?
I guess,
take that first
well,
time.
It depends on why they're disillusioned. Yeah, that's sort of a hard question. What advice do you give them? Is it because of time? Is it because of the teacher? Is it because they're not seeing results? I mean, my advice is always, this is the best thing in the world, and yoga is your companion, and it will take you through everything that you have to go through in this life, from bearing your mother to sending your kids off to college to illness to, you know, whatever life has to throw you, changing jobs, getting fired, getting hired, birth, I mean, everything. So in my mind, there's just no excuse not to take it up. But sometimes people's expectations, as we talked about, are different than what the practice may be offering. But if they're disillusioned, maybe they need a different teacher. Maybe they're doing an Ashtanga practice and they should be doing Iyengar, or there's an Iyengar practice and they should be doing Ashtanga, or maybe it's restorative that's going to speak to them. But I think as a good teacher, you should be able to guide the student to where they're going to get the most benefits or the most balance to who they are.
I think Colleen hit the nail on the head there, and that is, you might ask them, you know, what they want, first of all, and what they're expecting. And you might have to guide them to a different practice. I mean, as we know as yogis, the world of yoga is huge. And there's so many multitudes of different practices. And, you know, it's like going to the library. I remember reading a book in high school and then reading it again. Actually, because I didn't finish it. Or let's even talk about the Yoga Sutras. I remember having to read it in 1982 at the Iyengar Institute and not being very inspired or, you know, even interested in what the Yoga Sutra was saying. As I've read it again, and Colleen and I have read it again over the years, and as I reread it again this year, it was one of the most fascinating books I ever read. And so sometimes it has to be the right time and right place. And so sometimes you might encourage your student, if you're getting disillusioned with the practice that we're offering you, just realize that the world of yoga is really immense, and that maybe you should try this kind of yoga, or maybe you should try meditation first, or maybe you should try relaxation, an urban Zen class first. So there's a lot of doorways in, and maybe right now the flavor in which you're being offered is actually not the right one. If you're not inspired and excited about what's being offered, it's probably not right yet. There's no need to persist and force yourself. There's too many things in life that we have to force ourselves to do. This should be a sheer joy in some ways. And yet, like Colleen and I will say, sometimes you have to get up and say, I'm going to practice, no matter how I feel.
There's also this principle, when you run the track, the first round is always the hardest. I think as you get a longer-term practice and you experience the difference in how you feel and your energy and your well-being and everything, then you have 1,000 reasons why you want to get to the mat. But when you first start out, that's very hard because people don't really they haven't had the benefit yet of experience, you know, what the practice can do for them.
And as Rodney touched on earlier, consistency is key. And you need to have discipline, you need to have ritual, you need to have consistency. And if you're not willing to do that, then it may not become the essence that you need to live. Or you may not know that it's the essence that you need. But yeah, especially in the beginning, if you need to be diligent. It needs to be something. It can be 5 minutes a day. But if you don't do those 5 minutes, you will notice that life isn't quite as sweet. And then maybe, you know, 2 months down the road, you'll dedicate 10 minutes. Who was the author that said, or the dancer that said the most creative thing that she does is she gets her butt in a taxi cab at 5:30 every single morning?
Twyla Tharp wrote a book on creativity. And she said the most important aspect to creativity was actually getting in the taxi at 5:30 in the morning. And that was the beginning. And that's what you're saying, that first run around the track can often be the most difficult. So, you know, if we were the shop for a pair of shoes, you might go to 10 different stores just to look out, look around and see what's out there. And then finally, maybe third, fourth day, maybe you'll find something right away.
Yeah, maybe you're just drawn in. It's like, oh, this is for me.
You never know. So what I would say, though, if you're a beginning student, shop around a little bit. Don't get stuck at one studio. Check out a lot of different teachers at the same studio. Check out a bunch of different studios. Check out a bunch of different styles. And probably you're going to find something that strikes you literally right between the eyes, and it's going to be like, wow, I really like that. And that's probably your doorway in.
That's a great point.
It's funny, when it fits, it almost just, it makes your skin, the hair on your skin stands up. It's like you start buzzing from head to toe when it's like you become so alive when that piece of the puzzle clicks in. It's like, you know, Sharon Gannon says that the state of yoga is the state of nothing missing. And when you get a glimpse of that, your whole world lights up.
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, speaking of teaching and teachers who can help people get in touch with that experience of the whole world lighting up, Jane Adams in Montana is asking, can you please talk a little about how you managed to have a huge workshop with people of many different levels of ability and provide a great experience for all? And I think for anyone who is a yoga teacher, that's a big mystery.
Yeah, you know, I think it depends. Like if you're really teaching a workshop, you have a little bit more time to really create an arc. And that arc, first of all, if you're teaching people that don't know you, you have to teach, really, they have to get used to your language, your presence, the way you present. And so you start off slow, and you start off with something that really brings them in, though, also. And realize that the advanced practitioner eventually becomes more interested in the really subtle aspects. So they don't need a lot to tie them in. What you teach is you teach a sort of a medium-level class in which in the beginning it starts off easy and it builds so everybody gets involved. And then you make a couple of little points here and there that everybody can chew on. I mean, if you basically say, let's be attentive to how the breath is being absorbed in the body, a beginner can take that, and also a very advanced practitioner can take that. If you say, ground the heel, and ground the outer back heel in your standing poses, that's going to mean something to a person who's been practicing 5 minutes or someone who's been practicing for 5 years or 50 years. There's always more to a simple, good instruction. So, you know, and then when you say perfect your drishti by gazing over your nose, maybe 8 feet in front of you, Richard Rosen worked on relaxing his eyes for 2 years. That was his yoga practice for 2 years. So all of these beautiful, simple instructions there's a never-ending depth to some of these things. So we have to understand we're basically all in the same boat. I mean, sometimes there's a genius, sometimes there's a person that's never going to understand, that's fine, but for the most part, we're all in the same boat. And very simple, precise instruction with good sequencing can be profound for all levels.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that it's really interesting because a lot of times the beginners don't really want to be treated like beginners. They don't want to be called out. So what I tell students a lot of times is if you're intelligent and know that you can take care of yourself, throw yourself into an open class or an intermediate class and fumble around a little bit. And I think that for beginners, we spend too much time, if you're teaching a big class and there's like three or four people that don't really know what you're doing, they're doing, give them a couple of corrections, but just let them alone. They don't want to feel defeated. You know, you can be attentive. But I think it's important in a mixed level class not to necessarily cater to the beginners.
You can teach a fairly advanced class that's not dangerous.
Absolutely.
And so if it's not dangerous, that fumbling around that Colleen's talking about is actually a very important part of the process throughout our entire yoga inquiry. That, I mean, we're always bumbling around on some level or another, regardless of whether it's on a flat stage or whether it's on a pinnacle. We're all sort of bumbling around. That's the essence of learning. So as long as you're curious and you're willing to play, and, you know, the teacher needs to lead people through something, and if they see someone doing dangerous things, then they need to really be attentive to that person and say, no, wait, you need to back up. So the safety and the danger aspect are important. Other than that, we're all off balance. We're all falling constantly.
Yeah, we have a thing in class we say all the time, and it's any amount. Like, your pose doesn't have to look like this 18-year-old that's super flexible over here. So we can have a really flexible 18-year-old and a 75-year-old in the same class doing the same pose, but any amount. You can do Kapotasana. You can be 80 years old and take the architecture of Kapotasana. You don't have to have your forearms on the floor, grabbing your feet and your head on the floor or on your feet, but you can take that general architecture. You can put blankets underneath your shins. You can put your thighs at the wall. You can, you know, take your hands to the top of your butt and barely lift your chest. And it's like, okay, this is my Kapotasana.
You know, a small circle is actually still a circle. A big circle is still a circle.
Right.
And that's why when Colleen's saying the general architecture, you know, a general back bend, a little back bend where you're barely leaning back and up is the same as a full drop back. It really is the exact same. It's just in a smaller amount. And sometimes, believe it or not, the smaller amount is actually the more advanced practitioner. You know, a lot of times it's advanced beginners and beginning intermediate students that think they have to take the full-on foot-to-head or so-on pose. That's really just more dramatic, but not necessarily more profound.
And it's up to the teacher to be able to transmit that to the students, to be able to tell the class, this is not about range of motion. This is about freeing up the body so that the breath can be easy. And in that easiness, there's less anger, there's less desperation, there's less struggle. So we're just unwinding the body. And who was it that said, you know, those unfortunate, flexible people have to go to such extremes.
That's Richard Freeman.
Right, to find this sense of unlocking. But the teacher needs to know and to also portray that the goal is not to get into a picture that you see in Light on Yoga or in Yoga Journal.
You know, and that's where the energy running through an architecture is in some ways more profound than just the general architecture. And people really have to understand that, you know, up until the last 100 years of yoga, flexibility had nothing to do with the practice. So what were they doing for, 2,000 years before that? They were really trying to quiet the fluctuations of the mind through work with pranayama and good, easy posture. And that is something we should remember to focus on as teachers.
Yeah, and of course, when we talk about the range of teaching, we also have to talk about the work that you've been doing with the Urban Zen program, where you work with people in hospitals, hospital beds, where almost inevitably the focus has to shift away from yoga asana because, people won't be able to do even the simplest asana. So tell us about the Urban Zen program and the experience of creating it. And also, if you don't mind, mention some of the guiding principles you used when putting that program together to help people still get an experience of yoga even though they actually can't do any postures.
How much time do we have here? This one question can take 8 hours. I'll just start by saying how it started and let Rodney fill in a lot more of the details. But it started, Donna Karen's late husband, Stephen Weiss, was sick with lung cancer and was sick for 7 years. And Donna has been into yoga and alternative therapies pretty much her whole life since she was a teenager. And her husband wasn't. But when he was sick, Donna would bring her what he would call her woo-woos in and ended up giving him a lot of comfort. And with the essential oils and the Reiki and the good nutrition and the restorative yoga practices and the meditation. And, so he was getting all of this care from Donna's woo-woos. And one of his dying wishes was, this needs to be available to everybody. And Donna, please take care of the nurses. They are angels, and they're overworked, and they're really tired. And so Donna was sitting having dinner with Rodney and I, but we've taught her for many years, and said, how am I going to make my husband's dying wish come to fruition? And so we brainstormed and thought, the yoga community is a perfect community to get into the hospitals, get to the patient's bedside, to free up the nurses, even to give the nurses some techniques. I mean, we get into yoga not to become rich and famous, obviously. We get into yoga because we want to help, we want to serve, we want to better mankind. So we thought this was a perfect place to pull these people in and say, this is what we're going to do. We're going to get into the hospital. And so we pulled together a 10-day initiative and invited all of the doctors and nurses and said, how can we help? What is it that's missing? How can we help? The system is broken. We know that. And go ahead, Rod. You can take it from there.
So that was in 2007. And Colleen and I were both shocked that we had over 1,000 doctors and nurses every day for 10 days. We also had some of the greatest yoga teachers in the world and some other allied health professionals. And really what we came to, it was really the birth of what we called Urban Zen Integrative Therapy. And we got to utilize this idea further at when Eve Ensler, basically at the Superdome in New Orleans, had the 10th anniversary of her vagina monologues. And for that, she threw a huge health and wellness festival at the Superdome, where a lot of those people had refuge during the hurricane. During that time, we had the Urban Zen Lounge. At the Urban Zen Lounge, more than 6,000 people came through that lounge during one weekend. And we had some of the most severely battered and abused women in New Orleans come through that lounge. We gave them restorative yoga. We gave them nutritional juices. We gave them Reiki. And we gave them essential oils and contemplative care meditation. And so this was the real beginning of using five modalities, which are yoga therapy, essential oil therapy, Reiki, knowledge and nutrition, and contemplative care together for the first time. And as they're used together, they're working on what we call the symptoms of panic, and that's pain, anxiety, nausea, insomnia, and constipation, and later we added exhaustion. So we have put together this program so that when people are in whatever situation, whether it's at their workplace, whether it's a veteran of foreign war, whether it's a person in the hospital, whether it's a child about ready to take an exam at school, what we found is if we put them in the right restorative poses, if we do the right small movements of the body, if we talk them through a body scan meditation with the right breath awareness, with the right essential oil, as we do Reiki on them, we immediately bring them to a state of greater relaxation. And we believe that when the person, whoever, whatever they're going through, whenever they're a little bit more relaxed and a little bit more present, we've done our job. Because it's in that state of presence and relaxation that natural healing takes place.
And it's actually been incredibly healing for the allied healthcare professionals themselves as far as self-care is concerned. The letters that we get would completely break your heart. If you want to get everyone crying on the phone, we can read you a couple of them, but we won't. It's incredible, from nurses that feel like they got to do their job for the first time in 15 years when they took someone off life support and did all of these modalities with the family, to the little girl with leukemia that finally slept for the first time in 6 months.
And with her mother
sleeping. With her mother sleeping. Yeah, I mean, we went into the room, Rodney and I actually did that session with them. It's nice to, at our age, to be able to do something like this. We love teaching public classes and workshops and teacher trainings, but to take it into this realm is rewarding and satisfying.
So you have to know also that we've trained over 250 allied health professionals at UCLA. We're also at Ohio State University at the Wexner Center teaching people there. And we're also at about 10 different yoga studios where we're teaching Urban Zen Integrative Therapy. We're probably at 10 different hospitals in New York City. We're at the Oakland Public Schools in Oakland, California, and we've worked with veterans of foreign war. So you have to understand that we've been now doing this since really 2006. It's almost been 10 years, and we're just now getting the traction where we can really make a nationwide program out of it and a nationwide career out of Urban Zen Integrative Therapy. What you should know also is 5 years ago, Colleen and I introduced this to the Yoga Journal conferences. And at first we had maybe 30 to 50 people in those classes. In the last 3 years, every time we teach this class at Yoga Journal conferences, we have 250 to 300 people in those classes. People are finally realizing they're burnt out, they're stressed out, they're at the end of their ropes. And they need to learn restoratives with breath awareness and meditation, along with essential oils and self-Reiki. It's a really powerful combination.
That's beautiful. So are you guys trained in Reiki as well, or you have other people who teach with you?
We're trained in Reiki. We're not yet Reiki masters, so we have Reiki masters that do that part of it.
And we also have essential oil therapists that are masters in their own realm. And that's what's so great, is that we've been able, with Donna Karen, to find really the masters in these five modalities in the United States. Of course, you know, Colleen and I have been in yoga for so long. We also just know really amazing people in those worlds. So we've collected, if you will, the best of the best.
That's beautiful. And you have satellite centers throughout the country where through the is yoga studios through which you teach the Urban Zen program, or how does that work?
Yes, we're down in UCLA and also Los Angeles area through Yoga Works. In the Oakland area, we have through what was the Piedmont Yoga Studio. It's now Piedmont Yoga Studio Without Walls. We're also at in Ohio, in Columbus, teaching with Yoga on High there. And then we're also teaching all around the New York area. We plan to start teaching in Dallas and also Miami, Chicago, and also more extensively, again, in the Oakland Bay Area, because we are going to begin to work with UCSF in infant mortality.
That's beautiful.
And so even if somebody doesn't have a desire to be in the hospital or to use these modalities in that way, for teachers that do the training, their classes take on a completely different essence. It's really interesting to watch a teacher transform from before they take the training until after. Just the confidence with which they use their hands and set up the restorative poses and the precision in their language that they have learned from the body scan meditations, like that. It's a really worthwhile thing to do for yourself, and then to learn to do self-Reiki. I set myself up in self-Reiki in a restorative pose pretty much every day. And the
she's taking a nap, but she's not.
I'm doing self-Reiki. No, but the tools are some that are such that I think every yoga teacher and every doctor and nurse, actually every human being, should have in their tool belt.
You know, I think what Colleen just said about, you know, how as yoga teachers, there's certain things we need. And we started this whole conversation tonight about the inner yoga. And I can't tell you, this training begins to bring you on that journey from the architecture of the poses much deeper into feeling the subtle movements, feeling the respiration, the digestion, the meditation. It's really extraordinary.
That's why we have to laugh when somebody says, you know, I can't do yoga, I hurt my finger. I can't do yoga, I broke my leg. I can't do yoga, I'm just not flexible, you know, et cetera. We teach yoga to people in the hospitals that have no limbs. We teach yoga to people in the hospitals that are in a coma, literally. So have to say there's no excuses for you not to practice yoga. You know, it doesn't matter what your age is, what your illness is, what your
state of being is.
Yeah, and sort of in relation to this, this is a very big question here, and you're probably going to tell this person to go take the Urban Zen training program, but Sunny in Temple City, California is asking, how can we help a student with depression?
How can you help a student with depression? Well, first of all, don't try to parlay information that you don't have. Teach what you know. Don't make anything up and pretend like you know something that you don't know. We have seen that be quite dangerous. But there are things that you can do to help someone who is sad. And, you know, that actually is another plug for the book, but I do have a chapter in that in the book. But somebody who's depressed, if you think about depression, it's someone who's sort of does an inhale. They're sort of collapsed. Their chest is collapsed. They don't want to take in. They want to shut themselves away. So in that way, it's a little bit the same as fear, that someone who's sad, like you catch them in a corner rolled up in a position, you leave them there. You put a blanket over them. You start to give them Reiki on their back. But slowly the goal is to get them to open up, to inhale, to receive the beauty that life has to offer. And you can do this from the body. You know, the body is so wise. It has so much wisdom. It reacts and acts almost without the mind. But we tend to not listen to the body. So if you can teach the body to open up and not be depressed, then the mind could follow. But again, it's important not to pretend like we're psychiatrists or clinicians, but to address what you see in front of you with the yoga perspectives. And there's a lot that you can do. I mean, you know, as a yogi, the days that you wake up depressed or and sometimes it's acute sadness rather than chronic, but you're going to feel better. You lay over a bolster, you know, you do some back bends, some heart openers. You sit with your back against the wall and watch some breaths. I love to put color or flowers or a nice scent in the room. Helps enormously. But yeah, just like the fear, you meet them where they are, and then you slowly get them to trust and to open up. And the goal is to get them to inhale. And back bends will give you a more dominant inhale than will a forward bend.
I can't emphasize enough that, especially if someone is truly clinically depressed, that they need help beyond what a yoga teacher can give.
Absolutely.
You need, but that doesn't mean that the psychologist or the psychiatrist can't work with the yoga teacher to also come at it really from the body, like Colleen's saying, or from the breath, or from meditation. All of these are great tools. But also, we're not trained to really tell when someone's in danger in that way. And so it's always good at that point to have counsel simultaneously. So you're going to work with someone with someone else. And that's such a great collaboration. And we try to get people to network all the time. That's one of the things Urban Zen does. It's like, okay, you may be an expert in restoratives, but are you an expert in breath awareness? Are you an expert in oils, but you're not an expert in Reiki? And so it's a little bit like, hey, this person might really need a great Reiki master. So network and say, I would like you to go see this person. You know, so again, you have to really watch your effect on your client. So as you're practicing, if you notice that they seem to become more sullen, more sad, you need to change up the direction. And you need to really watch the signs in their body to find out if you're going in the right direction. But a general yoga class, like Colleen's saying, a general yoga class is something that for most of us is going to make us feel better, less isolated, more connected, and generally brighter. So I would say all of that is good, but just have a team of people to help you work with something as serious as depression.
It's funny, we have a psychologist that rents the apartment above Yoga Shanti, and we work together with him often. And it's a great collaboration to get a holistic look at somebody's difficulties.
Beautiful. We have a couple of comments and then one last question here. Natalie in Los Angeles is saying, Colleen, I just want to say I just finished reading your book and so much enjoyed it. Thank you for your honesty and sharing for others to learn from. Namaste.
Thank you, Natalie.
And Kathy Hernando Kathy in Hernando is saying, I have migraines and vertigo severely. I'm afraid to go back to teaching. Colleen, you are inspiring me to teach again. I never stopped doing yoga or going to classes, but your openness about not being sexy with a seizure today in the interview opened my door.
That's
so
wonderful.
She says, thanks, see you in Hollywood. And I think she's called Kathy Double.
Beautiful. Thanks, Kathy. Go for it.
And then Sandra in Encinitas is saying, this is a question for Colleen. Looking back on your life experience, which sutra do you find most useful that has led to your transformation today?
I would say Abhyasa Viragya Abhyantan Nirodha, which is practice and let go. Do the best you can and then let it go. And don't necessarily do it for a pot of gold at the end of it, but it's the process. It's like, here's my triangle pose and this is all I've got today. I can wrap my right buttocks underneath. I can soften my groin. I can turn my chest. But I'm not necessarily going to have some great expectation from that. So, you know, do the best you can. You get up in the morning, you do the best you can. You go to bed at night, you clean the slate, you get up again. I love the Dalai Lama says his religion is kindness. And just to really take that on. You know, you do the best you can and you let other people do the best that they can. And then you go to sleep and you get up and you do it again. So, yeah, Vyasa Vragya Abhyantan Nirodha. You practice and you let go.
Beautiful. And Rodney, for the benefit of the guys in the audience, what about your favorite sutra?
You know, mine is just the very beginning. It's and now yoga.
Okay. Commentary, please.
You know, well, it you know, there has been commentary on that very first statement saying that, okay, this may mean that someone's tried everything else and been around the entire bend, and they're finally coming to yoga, and that is like not only their last resort, but it's a great resort. Also, just from the very beginning, and now yoga, it's literally that's the whole essence now. It really is bringing your mind, your body, your spirit, every aspect of who you think you are, it's bringing it to the moment. And as one does that, I think all of the beauty of the world and as it is and as we're living it is revealed. I think that we have to learn how to rein our mind and our body together into the moment. So, and now?
The Atas Yogesh Nishashanam, I think, is that sutra.
So, there you go. I think that it's like any other book. I think a lot of times the very first statement is actually what the rest of the book is actually moving towards.
Yeah. Wow, wonderful. Well, guys, thank you so much. I think I speak for everyone here when I say that you're not only brilliant and wonderful and excellent yoga teachers, you are also just great thinkers and talkers and have these wonderful insights into not just the value of practice, but also some of the deeper themes of life and the struggles we all face in our lives. And you really have had a wonderful way of bringing the themes from your practice into dealing with those challenges in life. So thank you so much, A. Colleen, for sharing of that so richly in your book, and also both of you for sharing that with us tonight. We really appreciate it. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And keep it real, you guys. Namaste.
Namaste.
And everyone listening in, thank you so much for joining us and enjoy the rest of your evening. Take care. Bye-bye.